thing they need is for this guy to climb on the podium and he starts screaming at them for hours on end about how they're not good, they're dirty. And especially the one thing that really struck me was the line, "You must throw away of yourself. You must throw away of yourself. You are not good. You are not good enough to stand before Christ yet. So you must throw away of yourself, and then you will be okay to stand before Christ." And, you know, for me, I'm getting all kinds of flashbacks to Hebrew school, to all these different things. Like, you had to say the prayer. The boys were separated, and they had to say the prayer, "Thank you, God, for not making me a woman." Things like that. Things where religion is shouting at you, telling you, you have to do this and this and this and this. And you're a tired, impressionable immigrant, and you're just sitting there receiving all these strange waves of negative energy. And yet, I think a lot of people really, you know, I walked out of there shell-shocked, but a lot of people seem to, they almost breathed a sigh of relief, like going to a very damaging deep sauna, and they just said, "Okay, well, we were beaten with a birch twig for 8 hours, but now we're ready to go back and work the ninth shift at whatever business we have and try to succeed that way," you know. It was a very moving thing because it made me remember what it's like to be at the bottom of a place, not know anything, and you want to reach out for the figures that you think are going to help you, the authority figures, whether it's priests or rabbis, or even immediate members of your family. And when they fail you in some way, that hurt is so much deeper because there's nothing else that you can reach out to. You're all alone in this country with them. That's all you have. And that, I think, is the deep pain that Eunice feels and tries to express throughout the book. And that is, I think, why she turns to Lenny. She sees him. He's older. You know, there's certain things he knows. She sees him as a kind of authority figure, somebody who can step in and help her the way nobody helped her when she was growing up. And Lenny, sweet as he is, I don't think is ultimately up to the task.
Now, your character Lenny says at one point in your novel, "Who was I? A secular progressive, perhaps? A liberal, whatever that even means anymore, maybe. But basically, at the end of the busted rainbow, at the end of the day, I'm little more than my parents' son." Do you identify with that?
Yeah, sometimes when I listen to my voice and the intonations and the expressions, and I'm talking in a fairly sophisticated English, and my father's English was never that sophisticated, but sometimes I hear him so clearly. And despite our different political orientations and despite the fact that we really are from different planets, I can feel that strange life force of his inside me, which is a very unnerving, you know. I realize that as far as one can go, and I've come very far, and I tried to do so many different things in my life, in the end, you really are still them with all the things that you've done to not be them.
And I think, right,
you know what I mean? And Lenny mm-hmm. and Eunice are both those people too. As far as they try to run, in the end, both realize that all they can be is their parents, and added to that, the stuff that they've tried to do to make sure they don't become them.
You know, in our previous interview from 2002, you talked about how you tried out all these different things, Judaism after leaving the Soviet Union, then capitalism when you were in high school at Stuyvesant, and then becoming a hippie when you went to college in Oberlin. And you said, after all these manifestations, the real question was, who am I? Who is Gary Steingart? I didn't know. And then you said that the creation of Gary Steingart as a viable persona began when you started seeing an analyst. Mm-hmm. And this might be too personal, but I'm wondering how an analyst helped you integrate the different parts of yourself into a person.
Well, when you come from a country like Russia, you have very different expectations of what makes sense and what doesn't, you know. So what I think my therapist did in some ways, my analyst, I should say, is he simply listened to things and then he wouldn't render a judgment, but he would make me understand that the way I was brought up, it may work in some parts of the world, but that doesn't have to be my destiny. You can be a different person. Certain things will never change, but you don't have to be completely indebted to the past. And you don't have to be a complete facsimile of the past either. That is something very hard for people from very traditional backgrounds. It's like leaving the Orthodox Jewish faith or something. It's very, very difficult to do. So I think being in analysis for this long, and I think I'm almost about to leave, it's time to depart. But it has completely changed my life around because I know who I am. You know, I'm not. It's not entirely a great thing to be me. You know, it's okay. It's not bad, but it's a stable thing now. I wake up in the morning. There's no, You know, I'm not going to snort horse tranquilizer or run naked through the quads of Oberlin or whatever. Those days are behind me. And what I want to do now is just wake up every day, be as productive as I can, try to fight my iPhone fixation, you know, and eat foods that are low in carbohydrates.
I think I've heard you say two contradictory things in the past couple of minutes. One is that what you are is basically your parents' child with the things that you've added on to that in your life. But the other is what you learned from your therapist, that you're not just a product of the past. You can be yourself.
Right. Well, the things that you add on, you know, that's what that's something that therapy allows you to achieve. Those add-ons don't come from free. You know, when I started writing my first book, for example, the Ashkenazi pessimism, the Soviet Ashkenazi pessimism that runs so deep through my veins, did not allow me to even submit my first book for publication. I finished most of it in my senior year at Oberlin. It just sat there and sat there and sat there. Because, you know, I kept thinking, well, the same kind of thought that my parents or their parents would think, I'm not good. I'm not a good person. This is not a good book. This book won't make anyone happier, richer, anything. This book will simply air our dirty laundry. I can never submit this book. 1 year into therapy, I had a book deal. The book was, you know, the book didn't change. The therapist simply said, well, why don't you submit this book? Why? And not like in a, you know, why aren't you doing it, but simply talk about the reasons you don't want to submit it. And that all happened within the first year of analysis. So, yes, you are your own, you are your parents' child, always, always, always. But those add-ons allow you to live a life that is not the life that your parents would have prescribed for you. That's a huge difference. And the hope is that if you reproduce, your children will be even more so than you are. They will have even more leeway to get away from you, and their children, and their children, and their children.
Your work is largely humorous, satirical. Do you think that humor helps distance you from either pessimism or depression that is kind of inbred in you?
Yes. I think it's time to whip out the serotonin selective reuptake inhibitors. Yes, humor is what I have. People say, oh, he's going to write some shticky crap and he's just, you know, he's a humorist, etc. Oh, please. Without humor, I can't go on, and I doubt many of my readers would go on either. Humor is so important. I am here to have fun, too, with my work. I'm here to entertain people. Remember when you used to wake up and think, my God, I got to run to the bookstore because X's book is coming out. I can't wait to read it. It's going to be funny. It's going to be sharp. I can't wait to get my hands on it. And somehow, that kind of literature has begun to escape. I mean, there's a very kind of mass market literature, but a lot of the other kind of literature has become very academic. You know, a lot of it is taught in MFA programs. I teach one too. A lot of it can be beautifully sculpted, wonderfully written, like a little Fabergé egg, and at the same time miss the vitality, the humor, the feelings of being in love, and the worry about death that often gives rise to the highest order of humor of all, which is probably why Jewish humor is so up at the top of the charts. For me, that would be terrible, you know. And I want fiction to remain a vital force for entertainment. And not just for contemplation. Both things can exist. Why can only Mad Men tickle our funny bones when so much literature can do just as well?
Gary Steingart, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's always wonderful.
Gary Steingart's satirical novel, Super Sad True Love Story, is now out in paperback. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. After 6 years on Saturday Night Live and many supporting film parts, Kristen Wiig has her first starring role in Bridesmaids, a romantic comedy she co-wrote. The film was produced by Judd Apatow and directed by Paul Feig, best known as the creator of TV's Freaks and Geeks. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Judd Apatow has his own Hollywood comedy factory these days, but the charge that comes up again and again is that it's a boys' club. Or rather, a child man's club, a place for nerds to write movies about nerds who act like juveniles before growing up and marrying thin, pretty women. Where, many of us have asked, is the female perspective? Apatow is more responsive to criticism than most moguls, and has now produced his first female-centric comedy, Bridesmaids, from a script by Annie Mumolo and the star, Kristen Wiig, with reportedly heavy input from the man himself. As directed by Paul Feig, it's a killer vehicle for Wig, who's been glamorized here like mad, super coiffed and dressed in micro miniskirts with the aim of making her part Lucille Ball and part Jennifer Aniston. Wig's talent, and it's considerable, is for a kind of neurotic deadpan, a mask of blandness that regularly slips to make way for crazed insecurity and anger and passive aggression. And she has a good clown face for that, bland but rubbery enough to surprise you with its wide range of expression. The idea of a female mask, of women having to keep up appearances, is actually the key to Bridesmaids' best moments. Wig plays the lonely single Annie, who ran a cake shop that went bust and now works fitfully in a jewelry store. Her best friend for life is Lillian, played by Wig's old Saturday Night Live castmate Maya Rudolph, and their unforced rapport is one of the movie's pleasures. Lillian is newly engaged to a rich guy, and Annie will, of course, be maid of honor. But there's a rival from Lillian's new country club circuit for Lillian's friendship, the aristocratic beauty Helen, played by Rose Byrne. The movie peaks early, too early, at Lillian's engagement party, when Annie gives a modest little toast, and then Helen takes the mic and gives a toast that's disarmingly polished, and then deeply threatened Annie jumps up and takes the mic back, and soon there are dueling mics. It's a compulsive competition that, of course, can't be acknowledged, because that's not how ladies behave in public. Wig's timing is brilliant, and Byrne, who's not as experienced a comedian, turns out to be every bit as pitch perfect. But then come more conventional gags. Apatow reportedly pressed for Mumolo and Wig to add a gross-out set piece. So there's a scene in which the bridal party suffers food poisoning